Pardon me, everyone. This is the operator. Just need to inform you that today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this line, at this time, and you may begin.
Thank you, Lori. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone, and Happy New Year. Welcome to the IRTPD Working Group call on Monday, 6th January 2014. On the call today, we have Holly Raich, Mikey O'Connor, James Bladel, Barbara Knight, Caitlin Tuberton, and Avery Doya. We have apologies from Graham Bunton and Kevin Erdman. And from staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Barry Cobb, and myself, Julia Chauvelin. May I please remind all participants to please state your names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you, and over to you.
Thank you, Julia, and welcome everyone to the IRTC Working Group call. First of many great and excellent calls for 2014, so I hope everyone had a great holiday break and are recharged and ready to dive right back into the intricacies of transfers and transfer disputes. Per our standard routine, can anyone please indicate in the Adobe room or on the phone if you have any updates to your statement of interest? Seeing none, can we then propose that the draft agenda that is listed there in the Adobe room be accepted, or if you have any additions or comments to that agenda, please do so at this time. Okay. Well, thanks, everyone, and once again, welcome back. We've got maybe a few minutes here to clear out the cobwebs of hopefully a nice, relaxing break with family and friends, and hopefully no one has been thinking about transfers much over the last couple of weeks. I know that's probably wishful thinking on my part, but, you know, it's worth a shot. Wanted to chat a little bit about the item number two on our agenda, which is views of ICANN compliance on the TDRP. And there were some notes there that were circulated. I'm wondering, Mikey, if you are driving, is that something that we can put into the main screen here, or should we turn it over to Lars?
I mean, it's now in the the outline. I just copy and pasted it in. So the way it's organized is these are the scenarios. They had two chunks, the losing registrar and the gaining registrar chunk, and then auth code, FOA, et cetera. So I just put all that stuff in there. And so if you want, you can just walk us through that, and I'll open up the pieces as you go.
Sure. And I noted that, we seem to be 50-50 in terms of participants and staff. Was there anyone in particular on staff that would like to walk us through this, or do you just want Mikey and I to charge ahead? Okay, I think that's a vote for us, Mikey.
You want me to walk through since I can drive the screen at the same time?
Yeah, I think that'll be better for synchronization. I think that if we can, and maybe I'm getting too far down the road here, but if we can focus those compliance points that are directly, you can draw a straight line between their comments and what we're seeking, I think it would be ideal. I'm concerned that there's a lot of extra stuff in here, but we'll see, I guess. It'll shake out as we go along.
Well, I sort of agree, and I want to take us up one more level and remind us all that we're working on charter question C, which is whether dispute options for registrants should be developed and implemented as part of the policy. And it's really in the TDRP. There's a lot of conversation to be had about inter-registrant transfers, but I think we're going to have to tease these things apart a little bit. So, with that, compliance came to us with a series of scenarios. Was it Alex?
He
rattled off a whole bunch of them on the call last week and then wrote them. And so I'm just going to go through what he wrote in the email. He broke it into two chunks. The scenarios that compliance deals with in terms of the losing registrar are related to auth codes, FOAs, or unlocking the domain. And so what he did is he came up with a bunch of scenarios that basically, if any of these scenarios happen, it's my understanding that then compliance has a basis for an action. Presumably, you know, they start by contacting the registrars that are involved and go from there. So do you want me to actually run through the details of these, James, or do you want me to just leave them on the screen and let people read them? How do you want to...
Yeah, I think they're fairly self-evident, unless anyone has any questions. I don't see anything in the queue, but it makes sense.
Yeah, okay.
Me, I mean, I don't want to assume.
I mean, I think that this was helpful for me because if I can dolly us back out to the 60,000-foot level for a minute, you know, we have all these scenarios that we came up with, and I'm just going to flash them at you. I'm not going to go through them all.
Yeah.
And the reaction from compliance, which triggered the call last time, was, you know, most of those scenarios are outside of our purview, and they're outside policy. And now that I understand where they're coming from, I tend to agree. I think what we've got is an interesting black hole in terms of the inner registrant stuff that we came up with in IRTPC, but in terms of the TDRP as it stands today, if we leave that alone, basically, and we don't try and wedge in inter-registrant transfers, then these kinds of things, auth code, FOA, and unlocking related things, are the sorts of things that get addressed in there, and I'm tipping towards the notion that says not a lot of registrant involvement in this. I mean, I think there may be some sort of nudge that the registrant ought to be able to give if one of these, you know, kinds of things happens and nobody does anything about it, but I'm not sure that we have to be tremendously heavy-handed to get that working. So anyway, that's a little editorial aside walking through this. So that's the losing registrar stuff. And on the gaining registrar, it's very similar, except that there's no, in the case of a losing registrar, there's the unlocking. Well, clearly that's missing on the side of the gaining registrar because they can't. They're gaining. So the stuff that happens on the gaining registrar side is a little more limited. In this case, they allow a transfer in without an auth code.
Really, really interested in how that's possible.
Yeah, well, I think Alex was quick to point out that it's theoretical, you know, registry error maybe. Although, you know, again, one of the dimensions in our analysis up here is, you know, whether this is common or an edge case, and I think this is probably the sort of thing that we'd say is an edge case in any regard. And then in terms of the FOA, the gaining registrar sends the FOA to the losing registrar. So, again, some of these are pretty... I think this last one, the registrar allows the transfer without receiving confirmation after sending the FOA, is about the only one that verges on being in any way common, and I'm not even sure if that one is.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the sort of short summary of all this for me, I can't quite get it all on the screen for you, but I can get most of it on, is that today's TDRP is very technical.
Mm-hmm.
And at least from the standpoint of compliance, they view it pretty cut and dried, and I guess I would too. You know, it's sort of straightforward, and I guess I'm curious to hear from James and well, certainly from Aubrey, but more from Barbara. You know, the two of you are the ones that sort of deal with this more. Is this sort of the framework of the TDRP today, or are they missing a point? Is there something that you learned from seeing this list that surprised you? James, go ahead.
Well, I think Barbara actually has a lot more firsthand expertise with the TDRP, but I think that this looks good to me. My concern here, Mikey, is that there are layers here. I mean, the first layer when something goes wrong between Registrar X and Registrar Y is, hopefully, in a perfect world, Registrar X picks up the phone and calls Registrar Y.
Right.
So that's all happening outside of ICANN. They're like, can we fix this? You know, we've got a customer, you've got a customer there, you know, or we have a shared customer that's having problems or something, can we fix this? So, you know, there's a whole cloud of things that can happen outside of this process. And then it's only when something in this chain breaks down, as compliance has outlined, that, you know, we believe it's time to get ICANN involved, one of the registrars is just not cooperating, not playing ball, not answering their phone, you know, whatever. So, you know, I think it looks good. I just wanted to point out one comment that came up during when you were walking through the bits there for the losing registrar. There's a distinction, there's a line often drawn between what the registrar does and what the registrant does, but I think it just is important to reinforce that registrars are not typically going to unilaterally take these actions. They are doing so on behalf of or at the request of a registrant. So the registrant's actions or involvements are hidden or mixed in with the registrar's actions, if that made any sense. I don't think it's, we always can draw a line and say this is what the registrant is doing, this is what the registrar is doing, because sometimes the registrar is acting on their behalf.
Well, and through automated systems, which can be gamed by a malicious registrant, just to amplify that a little bit. Okay, any other thoughts about this? This, I think, is an important piece of foundation work and takes me back to the sifting job. Oh, Barbara, go ahead.
Hi, Mikey. I don't have anything substantial. This is Barbara for the transcript. I agree. I think it's a pretty comprehensive list. A lot of this we don't see at the registry level until it gets to a dispute. And given the number of transfers that occur and the numbers James had mentioned, you know, ideally people, you know, one registrar picks up the phone and talks to the other registrar. You know, a lot of them, you know, are resolved there. So we never even, you know, see, I would say, we don't see 95% of any disputes that may actually be occurring. It's a very small number that actually get to the registry level. But based on what we're seeing here, I think it does accurately reflect some of the items that we do see as a result of the transfer disputes coming up.
Thanks, Barbara. Anybody else want to chime in? I have some editorial stuff, but I don't want to poison your thoughts with it. So I want to linger for a minute. Just let this soak in. All right, I'm not seeing anybody. Feel free to chime in, but I want to go back now to the scenarios that we came up with and show you an interesting thing. A lot at the beginning, we came up with some that fall into the. So the question that was on our mind is, for all these scenarios that we came up with, we had several dimensions that we wanted to go through these on and make some decisions about. from a policy standpoint, we said, well, okay, it clearly the IRTP, TDRP clearly applies. Maybe this is one of those interregistrant transfer things that we don't really understand from IRTPC. Maybe the ICANN policy does not apply at all. And then puzzlers. And for me, the number of puzzlers has declined because the description of the actionable cases in the TDRP that's supplied by compliance narrows things and puts pretty bright boundaries, pretty bright edges on what's in and what's out of TDRP. That's good news in a way because it, I think, makes our job easier, but it's bad news in another way in that it leaves a lot of stuff outside policy that at least I'm always very interested in, you know, especially in the hijacking realm. But I just wanted to remind us of all these scenarios that we came up with. So this one, I think, fits. That, you know, that's one of the...
Mikey, this is James. Can I jump in real quickly?
Yeah, go ahead.
So are we going to... I mean, is the idea then that we would take the scenarios we came up with and kind of match them up to what compliance is saying?
Yeah, it's actually an easier job than you may think because it turns out...
No, I think that's a good idea. I was just confirming that's where we were going with this. I like that.
I think that what we wind up with... I started to do this before the call because I was feeling guilty because I hadn't done anything on IRTP. And so I went ahead and took our scenarios that I think clearly fit inside. And my thought was... that I would complete this job. I started this literally like 10 minutes before the call. And so I started putting them in these piles based on my sort of sharper understanding based on the compliance stuff. And I was quickly coming to the same conclusion that compliance was, which is, you know, we get into one like this. Two registrants are disputing the right to a domain name, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's outside the policy as it stands. It's certainly outside of the TDRP. It doesn't make any sense to me that a registrant should be able to trigger a TDRP based on this scenario. And I think that most of these are like that. They don't fall in those bright, shiny boundaries that compliance came up with. You know, as you just run, I'm just slowly scrolling through these. I'm not going to actually put them in piles now, but I just want to remind you that there are a lot of scenarios that we've come up with that we're interested in, but for which there is no policy today that really addresses this. You know, this one's classic. And so I think what that gets me to is that in terms of existing TDRP, Charter Question C is easy. Yes, it would be nice if a registrant can demonstrate, let me go back to the compliance scenarios for just a minute. If a registrant can demonstrate that any of these kinds of things have happened, I guess the question that's on my mind is, can't they already contact compliance, James and Barbara, if the registrars are sitting on their hands? Let me just pick one of these at random. The registrar sends an auth code to someone who's not the registered name holder. If a registrant is in trouble because of this, can't the registrant just go to compliance and bang the table and say, hey, they sent sent the auth code to the right to the wrong place. Do they need any more access to the TDRP than that? Is that the channel that they should be counseled to go through? Because if it is, then I think the answer to charter question C is no. Until we get to the quagmire of the inter-registrant transfer policy of IRTPC, and I'm sort of setting that one aside because the more I look at that, the more of a black hole it seems like. James, go ahead.
Thanks, Mikey. James speaking. So I can respond a little bit to your question here, and I think I like where you've taken this. And by lining up what compliance provides currently and what scenarios we've identified that are minefields, I think that we're getting to, it's kind of a brute force approach, but we're getting to a part where we can draw a bright line and say, if it's a single registrant that is disputing a transfer, an inter-registrar transfer, then do we have sufficient policies and compliance procedures in place? And I think the answer there is yes.
Right.
But I think you're correct in that if the registrant changes at all, it doesn't matter if it changes registrars. But if the registrant changes in conjunction with the inter-registrar transfer, or if the registrant changes, even with internally to a registrar, it becomes a much messier situation. And I think that you've hit on it here, is that if the scope of this working group is to focus on TDRP as an existing mechanism for inter-registrar disputes, then we're good. However, and I think we've touched on it in this working group and a little bit in IRTPC, that if we look at the inter-registrar transfer, or the, let's call it, inter-registrant, the change of registrant process, then this becomes a much, this becomes a briar patch that, we're tangled up in. And, and it takes us down that path of ICANN getting involved, in disputes between parties with competing claims to control a domain name, and I think that's where things get really, really sticky. I don't know if that's teeing us up for a way out, but it sure feels like we can draw a box around a big chunk of these scenarios and say, this is already provided for, it's this other stuff that's messy.
Right. I think that's right. And I think that, I'll go to Holly first. Go ahead, Holly.
Just a thought. One of the things that it seems to me would be really helpful that comes out of this is to provide some clarity for, say, registrants to say, this is the boundary of where you've got a remedy in ICANN, and if you're outside of that, then in fact you're going to have to go to other mechanisms, the courts, whatever. So that there'd be value in actually looking at all of these scenarios, but then identifying these are the things that are in the RAA or policy, and these are the things that will, in fact, ICANN can provide a remedy, and then to say, well, actually, we can't provide a remedy in certain other circumstances. I mean, that seems to me a really helpful thing to do, even though, in fact, we're not answering those questions. We're at least saying the reason we're not answering those questions is because they're outside of our rule set and something else has happened, and you're going to have to go someplace else. Thanks.
Thanks, Holly. And I hijacked your screen just briefly.
Yeah, I saw that.
Well, the screen that somebody pointed out on the list, and I did sort of a facepalm and went, wow, I've never seen this before. I think it's truly horrible, but it's at least a start on, I think, where we're headed with this,
yes.
Which I agree with, Holly, which is we need a way for a newbie registrant, a typical registrant who has one or two domain names, They don't pay any attention to it. They pay $9 a year or whatever it is, and something goes wrong, and they need help. And this is the page they get. And it's like, well, I'm not sure this is quite where we need to be, but it's at least a start. And so, you know, I just wanted to throw that up on the screen that, you know, there does seem to be some work to do in terms of outreach and information and so forth that probably doesn't need to be burned into policy, but certainly could be burned into a much better web page than we've got right now. Because I'll tell you true, that's a really awful web page at this point. Okay, any other thoughts on that? So we're sort of heading down a track that says, in terms of the existing scope of the TDRP, well, let me circle back to my question, which is, if, you know, I've left the compliance stuff up on the screen. If one of these things happens, is the registrant's, if a registrant goes to compliance and says, the registrar sent the auth code to someone who is not the registered name holder, and now they will not respond to me, what does compliance do at that point? I mean, if compliance just shrugs and says, too bad, then maybe we do need to put some sort of access to the TDRP for the registrant into this. If, on the other hand, compliance jumps forward and says, you are a winner. You get our full support in helping to resolve that issue. You know, that's where I'm at, is how responsive is compliance to an end registrant? And I see two smart hands in the queue. James, go ahead.
Hi, Mike T. James speaking. So, so just to address that, I would say that it is not unusual. In fact, it's fairly common that we would receive a request from ICANN compliance to say that, you know, something like, we've received a request from this particular individual that regarding this recently transferred name that you were either the gaining registrar or the losing registrar, and something was not followed. You either did not give them the auth info code, you did not, one of these scenarios, the registrant is contending that something was not followed here, or the auth info code was sent to the wrong place, or that they did not authorize the transfer, or that the person who authorized the transfer was not the appropriate person, or whatever. That is not I don't want to say it's common, because there's probably a lot more going on that I don't even see procedurally, and you know, they only come to me when they're you know, unusual or outside the lines a little bit, but it is fairly typical that we would receive something like that from ICANN compliance.
Okay, so and at that point, yeah, okay, fine. Barbara, go ahead.
This is Barbara. So I agree with James. I mean, I would say that, you know, more than likely that would be something that would go to ICANN compliance, and ICANN compliance would likely follow up with the registrar against whom the complaint has been raised. I guess my question is relating more to, like, the registrar sending the auth info code to someone who is not the registered name holder. So is that implying that maybe it went to a billing contact? Because there's only going to be a certain number of contacts that are going to be in the registrar system. So I'm guessing that when they're sending out the auth info code, the intent is that it goes to an authorized transfer contact, being either the registrant or the admin contact, and apparently it's going to someone else. Is that kind of what the gist of this particular item is?
Well, I think we've
Can
got
I respond to that, Mikey?
Yeah, go ahead, James.
So, Barbara, I guess usually what I would see in that is that the registrar either didn't send it at all, or that the contact information was changed immediately prior to the registrant, to the FOA or auth info being requested, so that the previous contact listed in WHOIS would say, no, that should not have been sent to that person, that should not have been changed. I mean, I'm just, you know, shooting from the hip here a little bit, but I would say in most of those cases, it's not a question where the registrar just chose the wrong contact in WHOIS and sent the, or some random contact. It was more that the registrant is complaining that the person who authorized the transfer was not correct or appropriate.
Okay, so in essence, the registrant's account had been compromised, if you will, and the information was updated without the registrant's knowledge, and then this type of scenario occurred. And I guess in that particular case, James, maybe you can speak to it from a registrar's perspective. Do you then provide, I guess, system logs that show when the information was changed and when the auth info code was actually sent out and to whom? Is that kind of how you would address something like that?
Yes, exactly. And in that scenario, I think you're correct, is that we would then demonstrate that, you know, the sequence of events, we would then demonstrate to ICANN that certain things happened at certain, in certain sequence or at certain times, and that there was a certain amount of communication with different parties. So, but yes, that's how we would try to untangle something like that.
Okay. I mean, I think that it makes sense for that type of, you know, complaint to go to ICANN, you know, initially if they're not getting the resolution that they'd expected from the registrars.
And see, here's the interesting, bright, shiny line. James nailed it. I hadn't thought of it quite as clearly as he did. But the shiny line is, if there is no change of registrant, this policy works fine. Where we run into trouble is when there's a change of registrant. So on this one, if the auth code went to someone who's not the registered name holder, but it's not really changing the registrant, then fine. It gets fixed. It's sort of a procedural problem, whatever. But the registrant hasn't changed. It's, it turns out that all of the stuff that I'm really interested in involves a change of registrant.
The hard stuff.
And, you know, it's kind of like, okay, fine. You know, I wish I had compliance's job because they've got all the easy use cases, you know. And so, you know, I'm pretty prepared to write a section of the report that says, here's the rules of the road if there's no change of registrant. And no, in that circumstance, there's no particular need for the registrant to be able to get to the TDRP because, you know, that process, we'd have to document this a bit, but that process seems pretty sound. But, and that's the huge but, what do we do about all this stuff where the one that's highlighted on the screen is actually triggering a change of registrant? And what does compliance do in that circumstance? Do they try to mitigate those disputes? I mean, you know, let's take the easy one off the table and say, yeah, that's fine. But what do they do in the case of a hard one where I come to them and I say, GoDaddy sent an auth code to Joe Schmo in Siberia and the name is now at a different registrar, and I didn't authorize it. Because that's when I want access to the TDRP if the registrars aren't cooperating. You know, the one where, you know, it didn't change the registrant, I understand that, and I think what this is it gets back to the history of the purpose of this policy. Was back in the early days, 1999 and 2000, giving registrants the right to change registrars. And they were, the policy's intent was to keep from being trapped by a registrar who wouldn't let them go to a competing registrar. And this takes care of that just fine. The big problem is the hijacking problem, and, you know, that's the one we still have to tease our way through, I think. James, go ahead.
Just agreeing with what you said there at the end is that this policy was designed to facilitate the registrant's ability to vote with their feet, to promote competition. It was not, or maybe it wasn't as common, and maybe it was anticipated, but it wasn't as common that a registrant would, that domain names would be portable between different parties. And I'm being very careful with my language here, that it's not that they're, that folks would transact in domain names as service contracts. So, yeah, that's the problem, is there is no policy for that. We tried to take a swing at this in IRTPC, and I think that we have a good result from IRTPC, but I think what we're seeing now as we explore the concept of disputes is that IRTPC was left somewhat incomplete because we did not draw very clear boundaries as to how one would undo a change of registrant and who would adjudicate that request or you know, that dispute. I think that's a, you know, that's a sticky question because it drags us down this rabbit hole of different entities. You know, one person's got a receipt for something they paid for, another person's got a divorce decree, another person's got a will, and another person's got an employment contract, and it just gets very, very messy.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think the historical parallel there is to the UDRP. This is Mikey, by the way. Where way back in the early days, ICANN said, you know, those trademark disputes are going to get complicated. They're nasty, messy. We should try and put some guideposts up in a policy, the three-legged stool of the UDRP, which has held up remarkably well, and some framework around that. And I'm thinking that the more I think about that, the more I think the parallel holds up. But I do, you know, I think back to Volcker's point, which triggered this giant discussion, which is who should pay for that. I think the registrants pay for that. I don't think that the registrars should pay for that unless they're a party, which, you know, with rules that set all that out. But, you know, where I'm landing is access to TDRP as it stands today for registrants, no. Access to some other as yet undetermined process to adjudicate and resolve inter-registrar disputes, yes. Payment, that's complicated, but I think that it's fair to say that it should probably be modeled on the UDRP since it's really a dispute between registrants for the most part. That's sort of the sketch of where I'm headed. James has given me a green check mark on that. I think then what we could do is we could say one of two things about the TDRP. We could either say, okay, we are not going to rewrite the TDRP. We could, but it's been around for a very long time. It gets very little use. The use cases are so narrow that it's not really worth the trouble of tearing that apart, and especially not worth the trouble because we're not going to give registrants access to that process anyway. And then focus all of our energy on figuring out the inter-registrar stuff.
Mm-hmm.
As a separate thing with a separate equivalent TDRP and adjudication process. James, go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Mikey. James speaking. So I am with you every step of the way right now and where you're going with this. I think that we've uncovered, I think, you know, if we can even go back to the transcript, and this is maybe just a hint for Lars and folks, is that what you just described is right, you know, exactly, I think, a bullet point on how we respond to this particular charter question. I think the catch is, and where maybe you and I start to there start to be some daylight here, is that how far this group can go down the path of creating that other policy. I think we can definitely, I think we've already started some really excellent work as far as laying out what it should do and what it should look like and maybe what areas it should stay out of. So I think we can put some boundaries around it. I'm worried a little bit about going too far down the road where this group is actually saying, you know, that that inter-registrant disputes should be resolved through a different mechanism, and here is that different mechanism on a silver platter. Because I think that's maybe a lot more people who aren't participating in or aren't transfer policy wonks may want to weigh in on that, you know, on that bit. So that's just one thought there, and it would tie into other things like UDRP and URS, which I think are good models. Particularly the URS is a bit about loser pays. I think that when you were talking about fees, and the answer is, you know, if it's a dispute between two parties and party A prevails, then party B should be on the hook for proceedings. I don't know that that's always possible, particularly in cases of hijacking when party B is just this, you know, mythical figure that lives in some country that just doesn't respond to these requests. But anyway, that's just, I'm with you. I think that when we, I'm maybe hesitant to jump into the pool where we actually start defining that second process above, you know, anything beyond just maybe high-level bullet points as we've identified in these scenarios and use cases.
Well, I've got a way out for you. I'll try this out on you and see what you think. Of course, it doesn't get you and me off the hook, James, but it gets this working group off the hook, and that is that IRTPC is in the implementation phase. And one of the things that this working group could do is give instructions and suggestions to the implementation review team that's working on IRTPC. And essentially stop there. And so what we would do in this working group is we would stay at that very high level, raise, you know, capture all the issues that we've tripped over, because we've found a bunch, and it's all buried higher up in this outline. Tidy all that up and hand it back and say, you know, IRTPC didn't get done. It's in implementation now, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that, but that's at least one avenue. James, go ahead.
I like where you're going with that. I like your idea there. I wanted to just kind of put out the possibility that even an implementation review team might not be well suited to address this. I'm just thinking here that there's a lot of other stakeholders that probably when you tell them about, hey, we got this transfer working group, come join, get involved, and they just kind of snooze. You know, and just wave their hands and say, I've got better things to do. But if you tell them that you're putting together policies or procedures to resolve disputes, I think that that's going to get a lot more people interested and involved. I think that, in fact, I think stand back and get ready for the stampede of folks that would want to get involved in that. And so I just feel like this working group and even the implementation team for C, I mean, we could try it. I want to get to solutions expediently as the next guy, but I'm just worried that the blowback on that would be pretty severe.
Well, so another approach, well, there's, I mean, the one that just sort of falls right in front of us is essentially to charter an IRTPE, just like Barry did in the chat.
Or call for an issues report, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's clearly the normal process on this. Call for an issues report is probably the correct one, actually, because, it's made more interesting by the fact that IRTPC already spoke. And I see Avery agreeing on IRTPE. I mean, I think that one interesting wrinkle to this particular one is that if we blow the dust off the IRTPC report, we've got a fair amount of stuff in there, some of which has been overtaken by aspects of the RAA. I see what you're saying, James. It's a new animal, so new animal as in issue report. Arvry, were you agreeing to issue a report or IRTPE? Because E we can charter inside a D. Issue a report. Yeah, okay. Arvry's saying issue a report. I'm okay with that. I like that process. I think it's got a lot of rigor. I would hope that we could do it threading the needle between the various explosions coming from IRTPC's implementation and the implementation of the 2013 RAA. That's going to be complicated, but I'm okay with that. Holly, go ahead.
Holly, for the transcript records, it seems to me if there's a process that can be developed, it would be around the fact that if a registrant has a problem that is within the purview of what compliance has outlined, then you would say if you are a registrant and the following things that have happened that are within the boundaries that we've just drawn or that compliance has drawn, this is what you do and this is what you can expect of compliance. If it's outside of that box, then I'm taking a deep breath and saying, is this an ICANN thing? Because if it's about a divorce or if it's about a will or if it's about a web designer that didn't do the right thing, I'm not sure that ICANN should be involved in any of that other than to say, look, this is outside of ICANN policy, it's outside of the RAA, it's a personal dispute, company law may be involved or contract law may be involved or whatever. We can't deal with this stuff. And one of the clear outcomes may simply be this is, with a lot of clarity around it, what ICANN can do because it's got rules and policies. And then we can't go beyond that because we don't have, we're not a court or we're not whatever. And that may be very, very useful, but the policy that we're talking about, if it's a separate policy for registrants, really ought to be, confined to saying to registrants, if the following situations have arisen and they are within this little box that we have defined, then you can go to compliance and this is how you do it. And it seems to me any more than that is something we can't do, but I could be wrong. Thanks.
Thanks, Holly. I saw James's hand go up in the middle, so I'll let James go next.
Thanks, Mikey. James speaking. Just want to emphatically agree with what Holly was saying, that there's just so many reasons why anything that would be proposed, and I think that's why the best course of action, as much as I, expediently would love to see us just solve the problem, check the box, and move on, I think that caution dictates that we should take the correct approach, which is that we call for the issues report. We lay out what we've discussed, what we've discovered, what we've researched, and then we kind of say this is a bigger thing. It's not entirely related to IRTPs and transfers. It's really about a dispute between registrants, and we need an answer here. And then to Holly's point, and it needs to be a narrowly tailored answer so that it doesn't drag ICANN down all of these rabbit holes. But I think that the UDRP can be a bit of a guide here because at least my understanding of UDRP's original intent and purpose was to take the majority, the bulk of disputes that could be solved outside of a court and address them through some sort of binding arbitration process. And I feel like maybe that's the path we could go because, as Holly points out, if it's business dealings or if it's, some sort of family law is involved or something like that, then, yeah, it's probably going to go to court. But those could be the minority. I think what we're seeing a lot of instead are aftermarket transactions that have gone south compromised the vast majority being compromised email accounts to steal FOAs and auth info codes, compromised registrar accounts to transfer names out. And it seems like if those were 60, 70, 80% of the types of disputes that were brought into this new policy animal, it seems very appropriate that ICANN could address those types of situations. But I agree that the tougher ones, and we should have a means to identify which side of that line they fall on fairly quickly in the process, but the tougher ones just are well beyond anything that ICANN was ever envisioned to resolve.
I think we're pretty much in agreement. Avery's been pretty active in the chat, so I just want to draw your attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I always pay attention to Avery on this kind of stuff. Let me rephrase that. It makes it sound like I never pay attention to her on certain topics. I always pay attention to Avery. Never mind. But on this particular kind of thing, Avery is much more familiar with sort of the edges and boundaries of what is done inside and outside of the issue report process and so on. I think that I'm quite comfortable with pursuing that approach. I think we could do a very good job of framing the questions. That was one of the things that's in Avery's comment that would tee up the issue report. And I think I'm going to make that just a little bit bigger so I can read them so that you can too, hopefully. That's probably another snippet for Lars to grab in his summarizing of all this. And I don't know. I feel like we've come a long way and are pretty agreed on our course here. I think I'm going to take an action to take the rest of our scenarios, that long list, this list, and I will start dumping them into those piles just as I think that may be a useful document to help us frame that inter-registrant issue report part of our report. And I think that we've come a long way on charter question C. So then we are about 5 minutes from the top of the hour. James, do you want to touch on the work plan this time and maybe hit it a little harder next time once we understand? Because it may be that we are going to be able to move a lot faster than I thought we were going to. If we're asking a bunch of questions of an issue report about inter-registrant transfer dispute resolution, then it seems to me we have a much faster timeline possibility than if we were actually resolving those questions. Do you agree on that?
Yeah, Mikey, I actually just wanted to weigh in real quickly. And first up, I have a hard stop at the top of the hour, so I apologize for that.
Yeah.
I know we wanted to talk a little bit about the work plan, but I think we're going to have to defer on that, and it's unfortunate, but I don't see how we're going to be able to tackle that here in 4 minutes. But I think that you're correct, and I would especially put the ball back in Lars's hands here, and I apologize if it feels like we're putting you on the spot, Lars, but we've been struggling with some of these issues for, most of the time, since Buenos Aires and even a few weeks before. I think we've made, to borrow from a therapist's vernacular, I think we've made a couple of breakthroughs here in this particular call. So I would just really emphasize that I think, to Lars and to Barry and anyone else who's maybe capturing notes, that this call really paints the way out of this quagmire in charter question C. And I think that we can then start, like you said, Mike, you really start finalizing what the what the initial report will look like, because I think we still are on target to have that either introduced at the meeting in Singapore in March, or even, if possible, receiving some more public comments at that meeting. So I think we're on the right course here, and I really like the idea that we take, and it's not a ICANN-type maneuver. I really think we've identified that there are a lot of things outside of what ICANN and even, you know, existing policy can provide for, and if we're going to make some of these structural changes, that we need to do so in the appropriate venue. So I'm good with where we are at that. I think that the work plan, though, is going to have to wait until next time.
Thanks, James. Lars, I think it would be great to put together sort of a draft work plan, just sort of lay the dates end to end and see what they look like and see what the fence posts will be if we were to shoot for a bit before the Singapore meeting, what's realistic given the state of the draft and all that. Go ahead, Lars.
Thanks, Maggie. It's Lars. Yeah, no problem. I was actually going to suggest to maybe send the notes of this call around both for those people who haven't attended today, so to get the key results of the discussions today out to everybody. And then I'll include also the an envisaged timetable update of the work plan, factoring in the Singapore meeting with you.
That sounds great. I think James and I are both a little sensitive to the pre-meeting logjam. So if we could get a little bit ahead of the typical flood of reports that come out before a meeting, that would be good. If we can set out a timeline that makes it mid to three quarters February, I think that would be terrific. It'll be interesting to see if we can do that. We may be able to, because most of the initial report is written. It's really this charter question C that we got so stuck on, and I think we're unstuck now. So it's top of the hour. James, you're typing. You got it. Yep, there he goes. Hard stop.
Yep, just need to drop. I just wanted to say this was a really, really productive session. Thanks, everyone, Mikey and staff and Holly and Barbara and Aubrey and Chris and all the diehards that show up to these things. And welcome to 2014.
All right. I think on that note, we'll call it a day. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Hey, gang. Julia, you can wrap us up. Aubrey's giving us applause. This is super. I think we did good today. Thanks, folks. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.